From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Leanne Hansen, filling in while Terry Gross is on vacation. On today's show, I speak with Carrie Fisher, the famous movie actress who's also the daughter of famous parents, has just written her first novel, Postcards from the Edge. Also today, a conversation with Matt Newman, producer and head writer for Not Necessarily the News, the cable TV show that spoofs people on both sides of the microphone. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums from country stars Dwight Yoakam and Randy Travis, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new Japanese film, Tampopo. That's all coming up today on Fresh Air. My guest is Carrie Fisher. She's an actress who is probably best known for her performance as Princess Leia in the Star Wars trilogy. Fisher is the daughter of Debbie Reynolds and Eddie Fisher, and as she has remarked, I was born famous. She had a showbiz upbringing. She dropped out of Beverly Hills High School when she was 15 and appeared in her first Broadway show at 17, performing with her mother in the musical Irene. In her film debut, she played opposite Warren Beatty in Shampoo. Carrie Fisher was last seen in Woody Allen's film, Hannah and Her Sisters, and she has now written a novel. It's called Postcards from the Edge, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. Carrie, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Postcards from the Edge. Was that title your idea?
Mm-hmm.
It was. What does it mean?
Well, I was trying to think of a title, actually, for something else I was writing, and it was, which I will never see the light of day, but it was the same kind of thing of sort of recovering from some kind of obsessive field day or something. And I was thinking, back from the edge, song from the edge, and the postcards from the edge.
Postcards. Because you actually write them to people saying, this is what's going on.
That was an afterthought, though. There was another chapter that started the book that the two things that the editors at Simon & Schuster actually did were they asked for just an epilogue so that it would start with the postcards piece, which is in the rehab, and they asked for another chapter. This is sort of for later on.
Hmm. Was there a lot of rewriting in this?
No, that was all.
That's pretty good for a first time out.
Well, it was edited, particularly the pieces in Postcards where Alex talks, and it's sort of stream of consciousness how he thinks.
Right, he's the very obsessive young man who
has a little bit of a drug problem.
A lot of a drug problem, right. But then he later goes on and kind of parlays this drug problem into a movie called Rehab, and then what, Son of Rehab or Rehab 2?
Rehab, Beneath Rehab. Rehab meets Godzilla. Those things were done into tape. So there was some bits of that were edited out, but the first piece appears as I did it.
Hmm. So did you get up early in the morning and kind of put that blank piece of paper in the typewriter?
I don't type.
You don't type?
It looks so final to me. It looks like that's it. Now they're going to come and get it and take it away and give it to the principal. I do it handwriting so I can cross it out as I go because it doesn't look final. It looks like it always seems then you can get it more personal maybe.
There is a character in the book, Suzanne Vail. She is the actress who we initially meet in the drug clinic, and then she is rehabilitated, and then she goes back to work. And at one point, she's going through this severe depression where she's in bed for 9 days, and her best friend Lucy comes. And Lucy gets invited to go on a talk show, and Suzanne accompanies her to the talk show. And while Suzanne's in the green room, supposed to be watching Lucy on the talk show, she meets an author, and she says to him, "Oh, you've written a novel. You're promoting the book. You must be proud of it."
Oh, God.
I'm going to quote you line by line, I think, from the book. "You're promoting the book. You must be proud of it."
Yeah, I'm happy with it. I like it. And, I mean, for me, it was the hardest part was over when my friends liked it, also people that I knew that meant a lot to me, that, you know, that I knew that they would tell me the truth. I have certain friends that are these very Buck Henry is this friend of mine who's a writer in L.A., and I gave him a part to read, and I waited outside by his pool, and I was terrified because I knew that he would say. So, yeah, I like it. Maybe I'll look back on it. I don't know. No, I like it.
I know. It's interesting you're saying when you don't type because it's so final, and yet here it is, you know, final bound covers on the bookstores.
Yeah, I think that I want to do it again. I want, you know, I'm writing more stuff now, and so one hopes that you improve and everything. But there's a lot in it that was sort of hard for me to do and true to me, and I like it.
What bits were hardest for you to do?
Well, you know what's funny actually some of the taping stuff of Alex, because it was very upsetting material. So it was interesting, the writing stuff, and that's not the bulk of, that's whatever it is, a fifth of it or whatever. But the writing stuff, because I didn't know about writer's block. I had like writer's buildup because I had never really written. I had always written sort of for myself and lines and this verse that I have written since I'm about 15 and prose and but just really for myself therapeutically or whatever. So it was like doing it for myself again. Hmm. And I'm a very tough audience for myself. So in that way, I guess it was difficult.
Yeah. You had written poetry before, verse.
Since I was 15 when I did that show with my mother, and that's when I did it. It was when everyone else was older than I was, and I just started communicating with this notebook or something.
Yeah, there's a poem actually in the beginning of the book. Would you mind reading it for us?
No, but don't tell anyone I'd done it.
I have the feeling some people might be listening to you.
All right, well, then don't tell any of my friends or family.
Okay.
Oh, wow, now I've done it. I've made a mess. I feel a fool. I feel obsessed. When we get to the good part, will I have something to wear? I know my heart's in the right place because I hid it there. I act so much like myself, it's a little unreal. It's a lot of work. It's no big deal. My heart's in the right place, ticking away inside my torso. I'm just like other folks, only that much more so. I remind myself of someone I've never met, of someone I'd like to meet, of someone I can't forget. I'm not insane, but I'm halfway there. You can see the smoke rise from my molten hair. Follow me down Insight Road, and I'll show you the sights along the way. I'm a flash, and the world is my pan. Have a nice day.
Is that something that you had maybe had hanging around? That you
no. Had? No, I have the stuff hanging around is more pretentious than that.
You think that's
some
pretentious?
I wrote when I was like 17, one that said, "Now I've been young and sometimes old. Life seems to unravel and not unfold."
Ooh.
I always liked that one. And you took my breath away, and now I want it back, and... Like lines, I would get a one-liner and I would stay with it a long time and build these sort of verses around it. It was like lyrics that were too complicated for songs, so they end up just seeming like gawky poetry.
The idea for this novel actually came from a profile that had been done. Well, it wasn't a profile. It was more like your opinion on things that had been written in Esquire.
An interview of me with just, you know, sort of takes and...
I remember Divorce Be With You. Was one
well, that no, that wasn't me though. That was just the guy that you know did the piece on me. Yeah. But from that, a publishing house wrote me a letter wanting me to do a nonfiction book articles.
So the life and times of Carrie Fisher.
No, it was never going to be that. It was going to be Fran Lebowitz West Coast is how they put it. Because I'm too young to write an autobiography, mm-hmm. and I don't have a good enough memory. Or even if I do, I'm not ready to do that stuff yet.
You said this isn't an autobiography. It really isn't. I mean, there are characters in the novel that essentially may have had experiences that you yourself have gone through. I mean, the woman is an actress. She has gone through drug rehabilitation. She had a rock and roll boyfriend. Her parents were divorced. We have all this sort of stuff. But I wonder, you know, when you're writing a book like this and it gets published, you have to go on these promotional tours. And you have to leave yourself open to the questions about your personal life.
Mm-hmm.
Did that occur to you?
Oh, absolutely. It did, but it's the difference between anticipating it in your mind and having it, yes, of course, I know that's going to happen, and it really getting into the middle of the reality of that. And it's not anything I mind, but you start to feel sort of exposed and probed and that the focus shifts off what you did, and I start to feel like I'm promoting the autobiography that I didn't write, that I don't want to write.
Do you prepare yourself for these sorts of things? You don't steal yourself in some way?
Well, I think you have to. Once it gets into certain areas, I'm not going to, if, you know, I have no wish to embarrass anybody in my family or of anybody I know. I don't feel that way about anybody. So when it gets into areas about other people, I tense up because I absolutely want to stay away from harming anybody. Or I'd rather say, you know... But it sort of was put up and established in front, supposedly, that I really didn't want to talk about the ex and the parents and the thing.
We got that letter.
But nobody has honored it. So, you know, I'm not going to get real defensive about it because that's, you know, I understand the questions. I would be interested if I wasn't me, and sometimes I'm not me and I'm interested. But when you're in that position of if I didn't put anything in the book really that relates to my parents or to... There isn't a rock and roll boyfriend as far as I can remember. I didn't mean for there to be.
Oh, there is one line where she says, oh, he was my rock and roll boyfriend.
Oh, well... One line.
You know I mean, I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, but it's... just that. It's just that then you don't want to feel like you have to comment on those areas. If I try to avoid them in the book, it's because I don't want to really get real personal about them.
Mm. There are some pieces in the book. I mean, it really feels as though they are coming from your heart. There's one in particular where, oh, the beginning of the book is sort of very fast and very funny. And then toward the middle of the book, there's a scene where Suzanne Vail, the actress, is going back to work after coming out of drug rehab, and she's living with her grandparents. And she has this long conversation with her grandmother about, oh, having a normal life. And she says, oh, you write poetry. Why don't you start writing greeting cards mm-hmm. and stuff like that? It's such a different tone than the rest of that of the book. Was it written at the—
It was written later.
Later.
I had written a first chapter that doesn't appear, and then we put the prologue in instead of that. That's what they wanted me to do. And then they asked for another chapter just to sort of compensate for that when they didn't care really where it fit in or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote Dreaming Outside Your Head. And it to me is really the most, it's the gentlest in tone. And I give to my grandmother the things that I would sort of say to myself, you know, be easier on yourself, or you kids nowadays. It's that generation. I always actually, in a lot of books, I love conversations with, like in Sons and Fathers of Turkey.
Yeah, yeah,
you know, with different generations when they're not warring.
Yeah,
it's always the advice is lovely.
You have a lot of dialogue in this book. There's this one whole chapter where the actress is dating a producer. It's he said this and she said this and he said that. Is that from sort of doing movies?
Dorothy Parker wrote a story called Here We Are, and the whole story is he said she said. And I got the idea, but I wanted to write Hollywood blind dates, soulmates without souls, whatever you will. And I got it from that. There was no narrative. There was no third person. It was just you found out who they were, where they were, all about them from what they said.
He said, she said.
And I like to talk.
Yes, yes. Dorothy Parker, when I was reading the book, Dorothy Parker came to mind, not from that, but from the puns that you use.
That's who I worshipped her when I was little, yeah. And that's what I...
You say cemetery for dead air. Well, one side fits all. At one point, the guy's talking about his terry cloth bathrobe, and you call him the robe warrior.
That was written from my friend Julian, who is the robe warrior.
The robe warrior.
Yes.
Because you're writing like that, and you're sort of trying to emulate her, and you love her very much, did you have to pull yourself back and say, no, no, that's too much, I'm not going to say that?
I actually, sometimes I look at certain parts, and it is... Because it's exaggerated. I was writing about obsession. You know, I wasn't writing about... I was writing about darker aspects of myself and then some. You know, I wanted to sort of cover that area. So now I look at some of the stuff in the Banquet of Crumbs, which is the date, the sort of romantic obsession section. And it is much more extreme than I am. And because everyone's taking it like a diary, I think, well, God, what must you think of me? You know, but I wanted to write it how I felt it, or, you know, I didn't want to have to think at that point, which I've done too much in my life, what is everybody going to think of this?
Yeah, well, what do you think everyone's going to think now that we're seeing all these stories about you everywhere?
I'm going to have to go hide in my closet or something. I don't know. It's hard for me to think about it. I just feel like, oh, it's so much. Yeah. It's too much. It's too much information. You don't need to know this about me. I know it about me, and I don't care.
Well, let's face it. I mean, it seems like we've known all about you since the day that you were born. I mean, when I was doing the research for this, the clippings were about 2 inches high that I had to go through. When you were growing up, or maybe, let's say later on, did you go back and look through all the clippings that were there, like about your parents' divorce?
That's how I know
stuff?
About most of it. I know about it like everybody else. I was, you know, 1.5 or 2. So I'm as much an observer as a participant in that, more an observer because I was so young.
Well, how do you reconcile that then with what you know to be what you experienced?
I don't know if I do reconcile it. I don't know it because I see it from the outside too, even if I'm inside it. Because it's sort of done for the outside, large chunks of it.
Yeah.
So, and the whole thing of Hollywood is it's a town without another side. It's the entertainment industry. So it's lived from the outside.
Do you feel you were, I mean, you grew up, you had a very sort of privileged background. You know, your parents were famous. And, I mean, people who do not live in Hollywood would probably say that, you know, you had a privileged background. Do you think it was a disadvantage for you as a person? Or
no.
Didn't think about it at all?
It's not, because they're famous?
No, because they're famous and they were celebrities and, you know, you didn't come from a very poor family.
I mean, it probably doesn't I mean, you know, everything creates problems and solves other ones, and it's just like anything else. I'm sure it has inherent things that are very problematic for me, and absolutely not. Just like any other situation, only it's more, it receives more focus, so it must be interesting because we're interested, but I don't know if it's that interesting.
You don't think it's that interesting?
Well, yes, I do. Yes, I do. But it just is paid attention to more than somebody else's life, which also has inherent problems and advantages as well. So I think, yeah, it has both.
Why did you go out of why did you drop out of high school just to perform and go into show business?
Because my mother was going to New York to be in a play, and I was hired to be in the company. I was hired as a singer. And I was 15, and I was still in high school when we were on the road. They were mailing me the courses, and I would mail back a couple of replies. So I gradually dropped each course until by the time I had not made it out of the 11th grade, I had sort of slid out of high school.
Did you not enjoy high school?
Yeah, I enjoyed it when I was in L.A., but the kind where it seemed like I was doing a lot of work. And, you know, at that age, I thought the people I was around were much older, and I wanted to be a part of all that.
Did you hang around with a lot of other kind of... You know, Hollywood kids, daughters, sons of actors, actresses?
Some, but it's not like a little, you know, subculture group where we kind of meet on Saturday nights and have a dance. There's a look that passes between us when we all meet one another, but...
No membership cards or...
No outfits, secret handshakes, little hats. Well, we do have the little hats.
You do have the little hats.
Terrific,
yes,
little
lovely.
Gold hats.
My guest is Carrie Fisher. She is a... Well, she's now a novelist who has been known to act in movies, as she says in her book. Her book is entitled Postcards from the Edge, and we'll continue our conversation after this short break. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is actress Carrie Fisher. You may know her from movies. She appeared in Shampoo, Hannah and Her Sisters, perhaps most well-known as her portrayal of Princess Leia in Star Wars. She's written a novel entitled Postcards from the Edge. We were talking earlier about how, you know, you really don't like to be asked these questions about the drugs and all this, but I'm afraid that there are some things that I really want to know. When you had this drug problem, did it ever prevent you from getting work?
Probably toward the end, I don't know about prevent, but it was like it was a factor.
It was. Did they let you know that?
Last year. Just actually one time, a director said, you know, there's some talk that you, and do you. I mean, I did some, you know, all of us on Blues Brothers got quite a reputation, so.
John Belushi, for one.
Yeah, just anybody who was in it, regardless of whether it was true or not. And at that time, I wasn't that, you know, active.
But because of this reputation and...
But I don't think it was... You never know where that stuff comes from, but generally there's an element of truth to it.
They considered you then a risk that you would...
I was hired anyway, though.
What was the role?
Garbo Tox. And, you know, I rarely did stuff when I was working, but...
You did?
Huh?
You did stuff when you were working?
No, I didn't.
You didn't.
I would, you know, use that as another kind of... I'm obsessive. I sort of do... I do it to death or not at all, so I'll try to do it just one at a time. So I do a movie like a drug almost, you know, or I'll read a book or I'll eat a... You know, it's just sort of appetite.
Sherlock Holmes used to do that in his characters.
Well, whenever he did cocaine.
He did, but not when he had a case. It was only when he didn't have one.
Well, Well, how do you spell relief?
D-R-U-G-S?
P-E-R-C, yeah.
Yes, or whatever, you know, label, brand you choose to come. There's a scene where Suzanne goes back to work after this rehabilitation. It's actually quite funny and quite sad at the same time. She's working in a B-movie. It's the second day, and everybody has something to say about her performance. Was Hannah the first?
No.
What was the first movie you did after you came out?
Well, that's not what this
came
was
out
about,
of the clinic.
Though. It didn't pertain to the first thing that I did. This was part of this happened on this Disney movie I did for a Sunday night, and part of it didn't happen on that. You know, it was, But the relaxation levels that, you know, and that's more not about someone having been on drugs and now they're recovering. That's more about like working with a network. And they're just like in there, particularly with women.
With women. Do this, do that.
They're going to control you. Who's the girl? Is the girl on her, you know?
Yeah.
You become a pronoun instantly. Mm-hmm. The thing in the dress.
Did you audition for Star Wars?
Mm-hmm.
What did you have to do?
Just read this impossible dialogue that was actually harder than anything that ever appeared in the script about nav a computer with enough firepower to blah, blah, you know. And I had just gotten out of Central, or I dropped out of Central.
School of Speech and Drama in London.
Right. And so I had done a little bit of iambic pentameter, whatever, some Shakespeare. So I don't know. I was able to sort of manage this unwieldy dialogue.
Was it difficult after this? Here you are trained, I mean, in this school in London, and here you go. And was it difficult to take it seriously? I mean, relating to robots and fuzzy creatures and, you know, toting guns?
Yeah, well, that's what Lucas wanted also was to, the tone was absolutely sincere. You did not play at Arch. It may look like we did, but we were to play the reality of the scene, not the surreality of the scene.
Did the surreality came afterwards, after the camera would turn
That's what
off?
You see later. But we were, when you react to your planet blowing up and it's just somebody standing in front of a board with a circle on it looking bored, you do it for real. You try to imagine what you'd feel like if your planet blew up.
I have a friend of mine who wanted me to ask you to thank you for saving the universe for us.
Oh, that's okay. I had that afternoon off anyway.
You got to work with one of the giants in theater in this movie, Alec Guinness. You've also worked with Laurence Olivier.
John Gielgud.
And now John Gielgud.
It's like baseball cards of the unbelievably famous English actors.
Did they kind of take you aside? Now little girl going to give you some advice?
No, they're not like that. Guinness is more seralic, is more sort of gentlemanly and fraternal. And I didn't get to know him that well on it, actually, because I didn't even work that much in the same scenes with him. I just did his tribute, and I said I was mainly there because I wanted to see what it was like to be in the same room with him. But Olivier, if you didn't ask him anecdotes, he would tell them.
He would.
And Gielgud is just amazing. He's 83 years old and remembers everything, every performance, Ellen Terry, people that, you know, we've read about in books that they don't have any film on them. He was there. Mm-hmm. They're great men for a reason.
Have you seen Spaceballs?
No.
You haven't?
I've been out of the country.
Ah, so you haven't
seen
it.
I'm not like picketing it or anything.
No.
I haven't seen The Untouchables either.
No, there's a wonderful scene where Princess Vespa, who is your character, is sitting and the robot is talking to her and finally she takes off the hairstyle and it turns out it's a pair of hairy earphones.
That's what we used to
say about it. Whose idea was the hair?
Oh, well, it wasn't mine. It was like a nightmare. I was so intimidated by the whole in situation, I didn't think I probably should have this job anyway. And so whatever they put on, they put that hairstyle on me, and I looked and I thought, oh, well, okay, here we go. You know, and George said, do you like it? I could have said, it's like a nightmare. I look like a jerk. But I said, no, I think it's fabulous.
And now you have to live with it for the rest of your life.
Can I take it home with me?
Do you cringe when you see your face on a lunchbox?
Or an eraser, yeah. That's the shampoo where you have to twist off my head and pour liquid out of my neck. That could do it to you.
Do you have a favorite product? That's the shampoo.
I think it's a shampoo.
Well, your mother, Debbie Reynolds, had a similar sort of situation to you in that everybody remembers her as Tammy.
Right.
And now
she did 40 films.
And it's Tammy is the one that they remember and you know, we remember you now as Princess Leia. Did she give you any advice about how to handle it, how to let go of it, how to help you through that?
Not specifically, I don't think. My mother has more like day-to-day advice. Well, don't do that interview. Well, tell them that you, I don't know. She's my mother. So she doesn't give, get a different publicist. They're kind of sweeping, but, you know, she did spend a lot of years in the business, so I listen.
Did she see the script for Shampoo?
Yes, she said, couldn't they have you say, she would have preferred
we
a
five-letter
word as opposed to the four-letter word that I did use.
So you talked to her about that. Did she give you any other, did she encourage you at all? Mostly for singing.
But anything, you know, she's very encouraging now about writing. Now she's decided that this was truly what I meant to do and what I was meant to do and that that she and Eddie had given me the talent of singing, but that this was a God-given thing. You know, she's my mother. What is she going to say?
Did you want to go in show business when you were growing up?
I never considered not, I suppose. Mm. I don't remember it being a big burning desire. It didn't have to be because it was everywhere.
Mm. You're now a singer and an established actress. Now you're a novelist. Is it ever difficult for you to decide what you're going to do? Like, well, I could do this, I could do that, I could do this.
Horse wrangling.
Is that what you want to do, is horse wrangling?
That's what I thought of as you were saying all that. It sounded so silly and artsy.
Sorry, it's your life and career.
Weaving and... I'd never have done the singing thing, though, so...
No. Do you want to do that?
Yeah, but sort of. And my mother thinks it's my form of rebellion that I haven't.
What form do you think it would take? I mean, stage, recording, rock and roll, country, western?
If I had a good answer, I could probably do it.
Right, you'd
so
be
what
doing
I've done
now.
Is I've, like, vagued out on the whole thing.
Hmm. There's going to be a movie version of Postcards.
The studio bought it, and I'm writing a screenplay for Mike Nichols, who's... physically attached to it as a director, which he's having surgery to get it removed now.
So he's not going to let go?
So I'm working with him on it, which is terrific because he's so great at structure and, you know, because movie values are totally different when you write these. It's three acts and you've got to set up the subplot of them.
Yeah.
So it's, and he's just great at that. So I really, it's an opportunity for me to learn so much.
Any idea about who might get to play Suzanne Vale?
Stallone.
Sylvester Stallone.
Don't you think it's the time for him to have like a more verbal role?
I think so. Is he going to wear a shirt or?
A blouse.
A blouse.
Like a blouse with like a lace kind of
a,
no.
Call
a
little circle.
I don't know, but by the time they'll do it, we'll probably be in 2 years or whatever, you know, if they ever, you know, it's Hollywood stuff, you don't know when it's going to happen. So by that time, it'll probably, somebody like a, Molly Ringwald or, you know, one of these Rat Pack people can do it.
Right. Is there anything that you want to do that you haven't done yet?
Oh, my God, probably. Yeah, sure. Oh, I want to go to Alaska. I want to go to Madagascar. There's like places that I want to go. I've never heard of anybody that went to Madagascar. Now they say the Russians are kind of more there than anything else, but it still seems interesting.
Huh. And after you go there, then you can send us some postcards.
That's right.
From Madagascar.
From that edge. Yet another edge.
Yet another edge. My guest has been Carrie Fisher. She is a movie actress, and she is now also a writer. And her new book is entitled Postcards from the Edge, and it's been published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air. On the next show, I'll speak with comedian Bob Goldthwait. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. from Philadelphia. This is Fresh Air. I'm Leanne Hansen, sitting in for Terry Gross while she's on vacation. Coming up, I'll speak with comedy writer Matt Newman. He's put his irreverent wit to work for both Saturday Night Live and Lily Tomlin. He's now the head writer for Not Necessarily the News, the HBO spoof on network newscasts. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker looks at two of country music's shining stars, Dwight Yoakam and Randy Travis. They've gone beyond rock arrangements to bring country back to its roots. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review the new Japanese film, Tampopo. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Today, our rock critic, Ken Tucker, goes country with a review of new albums by Dwight Yoakam and Randy Travis. These two young country singers have become stars since their first albums were released last year. But before we hear from Ken, here's a taste of Randy Travis's new album, Always and Forever.
You've been too gone for too long. It's too late to come back now. It's been so long since you walked out my door. Now you're just an old song nobody sings anymore. I got a new love and she's a true love. But darling, how could you have known? You've been too gone for too long. Now it's too late to come back home.
Many people who enjoy all sorts of popular music find it hard to overcome certain prejudices against country music. The most common complaints are that it's corny, sentimental, or excessively sexist, and that it's not a form in which serious work can be done. This kind of grousing is at least as old as the TV show Hee-Haw, which actually satirizes city slicker cliches about country music. These prejudices were trotted out again when John Travolta turned country into a snide joke in the movie Urban Cowboy. These days, however, many people who thought they didn't like country music are coming around to the pleasures of this pop genre. The main reason for this is a new generation of country singers who managed to avoid corniness while remaining true to the form's stoic sentiments. People like George Strait, Randy Travis, Dwight Yoakam, Reba McEntire, and Steve Earle have revitalized country music with songs that are simple, passionate, and intelligently self-conscious. At their best, these singers toy with the conventions of country, the funny song titles, the exaggerated drawls, the whine of the pedal steel guitar. Here, for example, is Randy Travis doing all those things. This is a song called Forever and Ever, Amen.
You may think that I'm talking foolish. You've heard that I'm wild and I'm free. You may wonder how I can promise you now. This love that I feel for you always will be. Well, you're not just time that I'm killing. I'm no longer one of those guys. As sure as I live, this love that I give is gonna be yours until the day that I die. Oh, baby, I'm gonna love you forever. Forever and ever, amen. As long as old men sit and talk about the weather, as long as old women sit and talk about old men. If you wonder how long I'll be faithful, I'll be happy to tell you again. I'm gonna love you forever and ever, forever and ever, amen.
That was Randy Travis with a song from his new album, Always and Forever. Travis, who's still in his 20s, is typical of the country singers who've come to be called the new traditionalists. He rejects the pop melodies and rock instrumentation that much of the previous generation thought was necessary to be a star. Instead, he harks back to classic country singers of the 50s and 60s, like George Jones and Merle Haggard. Another of the new traditionalists, Dwight Yoakam, is deliberately provocative. He claims as his chief influence one of the old-timers most despised by pop fans, Buck Owens, best known as the former co-host of Hee Haw. What Yoakam knows is that 25 years ago, Owens was the architect of the Bakersfield Sound, a California brand of pure country that was as distinct and exciting as any sort of rock and roll. Here's a bit of that sound the way Dwight Yoakam does it from his new album, Hillbilly Deluxe.
You've got your little way of hurting me, you know just how to tear me up. Leave me in small pieces on the ground. You've got your little way of hurting me, they're not too big, but they're real tough. Just one cold look.
That was Dwight Yoakam and a song called Little Ways. What Randy Travis and Dwight Yoakam share is their youth. They grew up at a time when young people were surrounded by rock and roll, and yet they made a decision to record country music, to reclaim it for their generation. They've done it so well, so sincerely, that they've become the country version of rock superstars.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a little more music from Dwight Yoakam.
Always late with your kisses. Won't you come to my arms, sweet darling, and stay? You're always late with your kisses.
This is Fresh Air. There's a very popular show on British television that satirizes current events. It's called Not the 9 o'clock News, and that show was the inspiration for Not Necessarily the News, a show on HBO that spoofs the news using comedy sketches combined with actual news footage. The show's head writer, since it began in 1983, has been Matt Newman. He started his TV career in 1972 as the star and writer of a local San Francisco program called The Chicken Little Comedy Show. He went on to write for Saturday Night Live, Fridays, and specials starring Lily Tomlin and Bobbin Ray. Most of the skits on Not Necessarily the News are built around clips of public figures. You may have seen some of these news clips broadcast on the nightly news. Others are outtakes that never made it to the air. When I spoke to Matt Newman from Los Angeles, I asked him how he gets a hold of this news footage.
Predominantly, we get it from the Sherman Grinberg Library, which catalogs ABC News. We also get NBC. We're getting some CNN sometimes. We get footage from UPITN in Australia, from England. We'll comb through this footage, and we'll find something usually that's just perfect for our show that no one's seen on the air because it's been edited out. It wasn't appropriate for the networks.
I was wondering about that. Do you have an idea and then look for tape, or do you see a moment and then write around it?
Well, that's really a common question of our show, because it goes both ways. It's sometimes it's the cart before the horse, where we think of the cart and we look for it. The main impetus is seeing something unusual or funny and applying it in some way, usually out of context, of course, to some future piece. But very often we'll think of something that where we need a particular statement or appearance or location for a particular personality, the president, his wife, the Pope, Margaret Thatcher, whoever, and we'll find it. But generally, you can't just hope that the president will stumble and fall down a flight of steps when you want him to. You have to wait a few weeks. He'll do it, but you can't always get it to be done just when you want him to.
You work to make the sketches as real as possible. In other words, when we see President Reagan at a press conference and then you cut to the room where all the reporters are, it looks like a press room. When you had a sketch with Oliver North, you actually went out and got a car that looks like his. Do you have an unlimited budget?
Oh, please. I wish that were true. Actually, we have a very limited budget. It's not so much a matter of expense. I think you just have to be clever and have good people, as we do, putting their best ideas together. There are a lot of things we cannot do because of budget. Many, many things we would have loved to have done that we just could not afford. We might have done them, but then we would have probably blown the budget for everything else in the show. And you can't do that when most of the pieces hardly ever run longer than a couple of minutes. So it's just a matter of being as resourceful as possible. In that case, we went out and found an old car that, when in close-up, at least, resembled as much as possible Oliver North's. In other cases, if we're doing interviews and we want an over-the-shoulder shot of the person being interviewed who's on the footage, we try and find someone most like that person, dress them that way, etc. It just comes down to a matter of good wardrobe people, good designers and props and set people, and basically choosing that material that is producible.
Do the people you satirize, some of these public figures, do they watch the show?
I believe some have seen it. We're talking mainly about politicians in Washington. The only problem is, because our program is on home box office, we have to rely on being seen by those people who can receive it. But I know that the show has been seen by a number of prominent politicians. I remember some years ago we had done a very lighthearted piece it was a record offer called Tip's Greatest Hits on Tip O'Neill, and all the songs were related to eating and drinking. There was nothing really mean-spirited about it. It just seemed to fit very naturally. We also had a wonderful clip of Tip O'Neill singing in Apple Blossom Time to his wife, so it seemed to work out perfectly. When Tip O'Neill's office was contacted in Washington, when we happened to visit Washington, whether or not he would like to appear on our show, we got a pretty angry reply from his secretary that the speaker was not interested in appearing on that program, since he had been made aware of that piece. In any case, we occasionally get feedback, but not so much from politicians. More likely, we get angry feedback from commercial products and companies.
Any examples?
Well, let's try Gallo Wine. I was particularly upset when we did Gallo's Wine, parroting those French wine commercials where they, where the punchline, I believe, was the taste was so bad they hanged the winemaker, I think. That's the name, Gallo's Wine. Another one that was actually had to be pulled from a run during one of the months we were on a couple of years ago was Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. Ours was spelled R-H-E-S-U-S, and it pertained to a mixture of mashed up and ground Reese's monkeys mixed with peanut butter and chocolate. Now, I know it's disgusting, and it is early, at least out here, but the fact is that the Reese's people, R-E-E-S-E apostrophe S, didn't take kindly to it, and as a result, threatened a lawsuit, and in some cases it's a judgment call by our insurance carriers and their lawyers whether or not it's worth to take out a deductible and keep the thing on the air. Generally, you're not going to lose a case like that because it is in fun, and if the piece can be defended on any basis at all of humor, and I don't know from your reaction whether it could be, but the main point is if it can be defended on that basis, generally you're protected by the Constitution, which I think is still around.
How did you get Edwin Newman, who is a newsman himself, to make fun of himself?
Oh, this was tough. We had to dial not just his home phone number, but the area code as well, to get Edwin Newman to do our show. No, he's done a few things recently that indicate he's got a wonderful sense of humor. He's a terrific guy. He did the show. He has been an inveterate follower of our show. Knew so much of the material. I was shocked. He wanted to do it. He flew in just for the day to shoot the material out here and. He was terrific. He's done Saturday Night Live and a couple of other shows as little cameos. And he is not officially with NBC, which I think allows him to be able to do this kind of work.
Do you start reading the evening news in the afternoon? Do you watch Dan Rather while taping Peter Jennings and Tom Brokaw for later viewing? Do you secretly hide newspapers around the house? Do you get the AP wire in your bathroom? If you answered yes to any of these questions, you are a newsaholic and you need help. Call us at the Edwin Newman Center in Palm Springs. I know. I went through it. I survived. So can you.
The Edwin Newman Center. No news is good news.
Do you have trouble taking the news seriously now?
I don't have trouble taking it seriously. I think it's by taking it seriously that we can find our humor in it. There's a certain amount of anger in writing and producing this kind of material because we do have a point of view. We have a social concern to, through the jokes, to hopefully educate the audience. We're not against satirizing anyone on any side of the political spectrum, but basically we're trying to make fun of the stupidity and the folly of what we consider to be major problems in the way things are run. So we do take it very seriously, and it's, I think, what makes us laugh so much is just how foolish these people are in their pursuit of political power.
Can you give us a hint as to what might be coming up next month?
Okay, I'll give you a very good hint. Next month, nothing, actually, because we're not on next month. Our next show, though, will be, I can tell you that, in November, and it is going to be not necessarily entertainment, which is just a catch-all for us to parody anything involving movies, television, sports, news, what have you. We have planned to do a parody of an award show, of which I really am not sure I want to tell you what the nature of it is yet, but I think that is going to be the wraparound, whereas we usually have some kind of running theme or wraparound through our shows, whether it's a news desk or some scene like with the media show was the budget cutbacks and the set gets constantly depleted throughout. I think this next show will be based around a very lavish awards banquet show, what have you, like the Emmys or Oscars or whatever those animal award shows are, too.
Lots of stairways and chiffon curtains, right?
Hopefully, yes, if we can afford them. If not, we'll just get footage of stairways and curtains and we'll make do.
Matt Newman, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Leon.
Matt Newman is the chief writer for Not Necessarily the News, broadcast on Home Box Office. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. John Hockenberry, who is co-hosting the program while Robert Siegel is on vacation, is joining us from Washington. Hi, John.
Hi, Leanne. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. What stories are you following today?
We're following the South African black miners' strike. It's in its fifth day, no sign of an end. And we're looking at the fifth year of the bull market, actually beginning its sixth year, 5 years old today in any case. A couple of perspectives, a big picture, and also a look at a trader who's only known up in the market. He's worried about when it finally turns down. And also, the Paleo Classic is a focus of a report tonight.
What is that?
It's a horse race in Siena, Italy, kind of a block party where neighborhood versus neighborhood and everyone gambles. They hold it twice a year. It's kind of fun.
Oh, thanks, John. All Things Considered is coming up later on National Public Radio. Huzo Itami is a Japanese actor and director. Japanese film aficionados in this country may remember his appearances in The Family Game and The Marioka Sisters. Now American audiences are able for the first time to see a movie he has directed, Tampopo. Our film critic Stephen Schiff says this sensuous movie will whet your appetite in more ways than one.
Movie buffs often turn out to be food buffs, too. There are people who like sitting down and taking something in, people who like being consumed by what they're consuming. There are exceptions, of course. Those who prefer to scarf down a quick McDonald's and then catch a flick are probably the same people who find wine lovers ponderous, sauce samplers dull, food writers notorious bores. They probably won't think much of the tantalizing new Japanese movie Tampopo either, because this slightly addled comedy of table manners proposes that eating well is the best revenge. Tampopo was directed by Huzo Itami, who is also a Japanese actor and a gourmet cook. This is his second film, and he turns out to be one of the slyest and most fluent exponents of a sort of new wave, or should I say new tsunami, in Japanese films. From Japan, we're now getting a series of hip, manic, deadpan comedies, brainy satires with a sophisticated pop art look, a know-it-all swagger, and a blunt, unsentimental sense of humor that's truly international. Tampopo is, so far, the best of these new movies. It's a series of wry sketches draped comfortably around a slender central plot. Two hungry truck drivers take pity on the mousy, mediocre cook at a roadside greasy spoon. Together, they determine to make her the queen noodle chef in the region. But it's an uphill battle, and the truck drivers have to hire a crack squadron of experts in their cause. By the time their food maven army is complete, the movie has become a genial takeoff on The Seven Samurai, and on dozens of other movies as well. In fact, Itami's chief method is to take a classic film situation and transform it into something much nuttier by putting food at its center. For instance, there's a tense boardroom scene right out of Executive Suite in which all the corporate officers gather in a French restaurant and order exactly what the boss orders, except for the young Turk in their midst, who scandalizes the others by grilling the waiter about tonight's specials. There's also a bit out of Rocky, in which the noodle chef, Tampopo, works out for weeks to prepare for those crucial sprints between the cutting board and the broth pot. And in the movie's funniest, most energetic sequences, a white-suited gangster and his gorgeous moll mix sex and eating until you can't tell one from the other, and wouldn't want to. The effect of making food the central point in all these scenes is at once absurd and rather telling. At first, the pursuit of yum-yums above all else seems agreeably silly, but after a while it begins to have a sort of poetic logic, and a kind of daffy suspense emerges. You watch people take a spoonful into their mouths, and then you hold your breath, hoping it'll taste just right. In making fun of the importance of food, Itami winds up confirming it. Or, to put the paradox another way, you'll leave this movie completely satisfied, and also, if you're anything like me, terribly hungry.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Ted Spagna. He photographs people and animals while they sleep, and these sleep portraits are making a contribution to science as well as art. Also, rhythm guitarist Marty Gross will play a couple of tunes, including the Fanny Bryce hit from the 20s, The Rose of Washington Square. And Ken Tucker will review two old movies just released on home video. One of them is Double Indemnity, which features Fred McMurray as one of film's great bad guys. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional assistance from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Leanne Hansen. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.